Memo to undecided voters. Al-Qaeda wants to make up your mind.
We do know that John Kerry really believes, and CIA analysts agree with him, that the purpose of the Al-Qaeda video, the bin Laden Halloween appearance, 2004, was to help President Bush by saying or implying that bin Laden actually liked Kerry.
So tricky, those terrorists. This time around, though, it appears the pre-Halloween apparent endorsement of John McCain is not reverse psychology. Security officials believe bin Laden and the gang actually would prefer McCain-Palin. With endorsements like these, who needs enemies? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 28th. Good morning, John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're going to take a look at the pulse of the voters by talking to some who've already cast their ballots. America's exit poll is open. And we're also going to be taking a look at the largest study of children's health in the history of the United States.
It's amazing. A very expensive study as well.
Very expensive, but potentially incredibly informative.
Yeah.
Those stories are coming up, but first we have some headlines.
A strong day so far for markets in Europe. Key indices are up across the continent, and Asian markets had a strong showing. Both markets around the world finding a silver lining in what was a down day yesterday on Wall Street. The Dow lost 2.4% yesterday to close at 81.75, but it's poised for a bounce back. Oil is also bouncing back, $64 a barrel. That's what it's trading at now. And if you feel good about the economy, you'll probably spend more money. That's why investors will closely watch new consumer confidence numbers coming out later this morning. The confidence numbers have been really dreadful over the past few months. Also, the Federal Reserve kicks off a two-day meeting today, and it's widely expected to announce an interest rate cut tomorrow.
Interstate 95 is the actual road that takes you from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. The metaphorical road to the White House, though, apparently goes through Pennsylvania also, since both candidates are spending a lot of time there. Yesterday, John McCain was in Pottsville stressing his tax policy.
If I'm elected president, I won't spend nearly $1 trillion more of your money. Senator Obama will, and he can't do that without raising your taxes.
Barack Obama campaigned further west in Pittsburgh. He was challenging McCain's economic ideas.
When it comes to the economy, when it comes to the central issue of this election, the central issue for working families all across this region, he don't get it.
Both men will be back in Pennsylvania today. Barack Obama will be in Chester before leaving the state for Virginia. John McCain campaigns in Quakertown, PA. He's also visiting Hershey, where if you go northeast on Chocolate Avenue and take a right on Cocoa Avenue, thank you, Mark.
Yeah,
anyway, you'll come to Almond Drive on your right.
World Series tied at 2-2 in the sixth. Rain delay suspended the game. It may be played today. And we all know that the world is very much interested in the U.S. election, so it's not a surprise that Al-Qaeda is endorsing John McCain. What does it mean, though?
I believe that John McCain has been endorsed by Al-Qaeda in an attempt to destabilize the election for a candidate who might otherwise represent a hard target for them.
You should weigh in. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Also, America's exit poll is open.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
My friends, we got them just where we want them. We love being the underdog, and we're going to win.
In 1 week, you can choose policies that invest in our middle class and create new jobs and grow this economy so that everyone has a chance to succeed, from the CEO to the secretary.
1 week, get out. Good morning, everyone. 1 week from today, it hardly seems possible. This campaign is coming to an end.
Did you say get out?
I mean, I just, it's hard to believe that it's only a week. It's only a week.
I know.
Only a week more. It's been going on for years.
It's extraordinary. 2 years.
Anyway, there was Senator McCain and Senator Obama campaigning down to the wire because it is the last week and the polls have been open for weeks. This is America's exit poll. And joining us now are two voters, actual voters, who have actually voted. And we're exit polling them right here on the program because there's early voting in 31 states around the country. Whitney Lovell and Christopher Rogers are with us. Whitney Lovell is a Democrat in Conway, Arkansas, who attends Hendricks College. Whitney, thanks for being with us.
No problem.
And Christopher Rogers is communications chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans. He's in Coates, North Carolina. Christopher, that sounds like a very important job.
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right. So, Whitney, where did you vote, first of all?
I voted in Franklin, Tennessee.
Now, you're going to college in Arkansas, but your place of residence is Tennessee, and you went there to vote early.
Yes. I went home for fall break to vote.
Well, of course, and you got to hang out at mom's and, you know, eat her food and all that sort of thing. But what was it like to actually vote?
It was great. It went very smoothly. Like, there wasn't a huge line. So I got in and I voted, and it was a great feeling, my first presidential election. So it was great.
Were you surrounded by people who were voting the same as you were, or did you feel a little bit more isolated? I mean, Tennessee is probably not going to move out of the red column.
Exactly. Actually, the majority of the cars in the parking lot were McCain Palin. They had bumper stickers all over them. But there were several Barack Obama activists outside. But inside, no one was really discussing who they were voting for. But considering my county and where I'm from, I considered that basically all of them were voting for McCain and Palin.
Christopher Rogers, what was it like for you voting?
It was a very smooth process. Here in North Carolina, they do not require a lot of prerequisites, but it was very smooth, no lines, and it was in and out.
Any evidence whatsoever that early voting is of particular interest in your states? The two of you, I'll begin with you, Christopher. We've heard reports of long lines and certainly a lot of interest, even though the process has been going smoothly.
Absolutely. We have been, in my county alone, we've already had probably close to 20% of the registered voter already vote in our county. So we are looking at unprecedented levels of voting early, and we're looking for a huge turnout on election day itself.
So, Chris, if you get a 60% turnout, which is not outrageous on election day, plus your 20%, you could end up with an 80% turnout in your county.
Very possible.
Wow. Are the people prepared for 100% at that point?
We are working our hardest. I am on the election staff. I'm going to be doing a poll watching myself, and we are looking forward to seeing as much turnout as possible.
Whitney, what's it like in your neck of the woods up there in Tennessee?
Well, but from what I've heard in Arkansas, that back in where I'm from, there's large lines now. It was pretty smooth the first day, but as it's progressed, the lines have gotten longer, and there have been more people. So I'm not sure the exact amount of people who have already voted, but from what I've heard, it's been a great turnout. And I've heard across the country it's been a huge turnout for early voting this year. So that's really exciting.
Well, because I have such a reputation as a uniter personally, even though you're a Democrat, Whitney, and you're a Republican, Christopher, I understand the reason that you are voting early is because you both are going to be busy on election day. Is that right, Whitney?
Yes.
Explain to me what your responsibilities are, and then I want you to tell me, Chris. Go ahead, Whitney.
Well, I'm a leader in the Hendricks Students for Obama. So on the election day, we're going to be going around and making sure people get to the polls, driving them to the polls, and also standing outside and, you know, showing our support and having signs and having buttons and, you know, just kind of a big party after everyone gets done
and eating bad food, the whole thing. Christopher Rogers, what are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be setting up at one of the precincts in my county. I'm going to be doing the poll watching, observing duty. What that is, we're just basically in there making sure that nothing, no fraud is going on.
All right.
If we see anything strange,
we
bring it up with the people.
That's great. We got to say goodbye to you. Christopher, who'd you vote for?
I'm voting for John McCain.
Whitney Lovell, who'd you vote for?
Barack Obama.
All right. Thanks to both of you. Whitney Lovell and Christopher Rogers, early voters. We just exit polled them in America's Exit Poll. Whitney is from Conway, Arkansas. She attends Hendricks College. And Christopher Rogers is Republican chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans. Adora?
Well, two more voters, America's right. Exit Poll. We certainly want to hear your story. And we're taking a look at some polling. The National Polls show Barack Obama ahead of John McCain anywhere from 5 to 13 points.
Those polls have consistently shown me much further behind than we actually are. It all depends on the voter turnout model. And everybody gets bored, except for us junkies, about the process and all. We're doing fine. We are closed in the last week. If we continue this closure next week, you're going to be up very, very late on election night.
Presidential candidate John McCain and his running mate, Sarah Palin, are hoping especially to turn things around in Pennsylvania, despite Obama's double-digit lead there. Chris Borick joins us now for more. Chris is the director of the Institute of Public Policy at Muhlenberg College and also runs tracking polls for the state of Pennsylvania. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
So is it over in Pennsylvania? We see that Barack Obama has about a 12-point lead in the polls.
Well, that's a great question right now. I don't know if it's over, but it sure looks daunting from the perspective of the McCain campaign. That 12-point lead that you mentioned has been fairly consistent in almost all the polls, anywhere from 9 to 13 points over the last 2 weeks. So the McCain camp considers Pennsylvania a key state. They're still putting a lot of time and money into here, and they keep saying that they're seeing something that the pollsters aren't seeing, but right now it's eluding me, whatever that is.
Now, Pennsylvania is an interesting state because there are very distinct counties, right? There are counties that are just straight Republican and straight Democrat. So how do you know that your polling is truly reflective of this mix?
Well, you look at the end in terms of both the demographic and the geographic mix of your sample. I mean, any poll is only as good as how much the sample looks like the voting population itself. So our sample, when we break it down at the end of any cycle, ends up being very reflective of both the geographic mix and the demographic mix. So in terms of how much it looks like voters, it's a pretty good fit. The one thing I will say, and I agree with Senator McCain's comment in the lead-in, was about likely voter models. It that almost all pollsters have to figure out a way to deduce likely voters. How do we know if a person's actually gonna vote? And so it's, I think, one of the keys this year to the poll's successes is going to be, as McCain mentioned, how good those likely voter models are.
But how do I know that when I'm looking at the results of a poll? How can I trust that they are credible?
Well, that's the thing. You have to look. There's a couple ways to deduce credibility. First, look at the track record of the poll. How's it performed in the past? Has it been able to predict elections accurately over time? But also look at the questions yourself, if you can have a chance to see how they looked at the likely voter model. If you just ask someone just one simple question, you know, call any household and say, are you likely to vote? Well, mm-hmm. You're going to get a vast overstatement. Because individuals, there's a social desirability, right? Everybody we train since we're young to say, oh, sure, I'm going to vote.
Chris Borick, thanks for that perspective. Chris is the director of the Institute of Public Policy at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, PA.
And on that question on whether it's over in Pennsylvania?
You say to people, like, is it over in Pennsylvania? We want people out there and we want them to vote. We don't want them to think that it's just an exercise of futility that, well, it doesn't matter. McCain doesn't need my vote. It doesn't matter. Obama doesn't need my vote. Yeah, it does matter, and everybody needs to figure it out.
All right, let's just be really clear. We're not saying stay home. We are saying,
right, we're saying if people made up their minds, that's the question. Is it over? Has everyone made up their minds and they know who they're going to vote for on election day?
877-8-MY-TAKE, but you can tell us to go to wherever, anytime. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And, of course, people are voting around the country, and America's Exit Poll is open for business. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As we've noted many times on this broadcast already, the world is very much interested in what's going on in the U.S. presidential election, so it's probably not a surprise that Al-Qaeda endorses on one of its websites John McCain. What does that mean? Do you think that could influence the election? What did you think when Al-Qaeda made an endorsement or an attempt to influence the election 4 years ago? Call us at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we were just talking with two voters who had voted early, a Republican and a Democrat. They had great stories to tell about why and what they did when they went to the polls. We want to hear yours as well at America's Exit Poll, 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Adora?
John, we're going to continue looking at voter initiatives on the ballots across the nation. We're heading to California to talk about the controversial Proposition 8. It is a response to the California Supreme Court ruling that made same-sex marriage legal under the Constitution. Opponents organized Proposition 8, which would amend the Constitution, defining marriage between that of a man and a woman. It's a huge battle. Dan Fritz of KPFK Radio in Los Angeles joins us now with some of the details. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And I've read it's the costliest ballot race in the nation. We're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million both sides.
Yeah.
Do you want to break this down for us? It's even in the polls.
Yeah, well, the No on 8 campaign is slightly ahead, but on the latest poll that I saw from the Public Policy Institute. But there are polls going on a regular basis from some nonpartisan and also partisan institutes. The Knights of Columbus did a poll also last week or the week before, which said that it is that yes on 8 is winning. And both sides have raised a historic amount of money. This is 5 to 10 times the normal amount of money raised by campaigns for non-economic propositions in California. This is the most expensive non-economic proposition that's ever been on the California ballot, and I think that shows how important this issue is to both sides.
Now, is this money just raised in the state, or is this really a test case for people on both sides of the issue across the country?
It really is. Mostly the supporters of Proposition 8 from around the country believe that California is the testing ground for how the rest of the country is going to work with gay marriage. And so they are coming in very passionately. A lot of the yes on 8 money is money from major religions, notably the Mormon religion, the Mormon Church, which has given a lot of the Yes on 8 money. And the No on 8 money comes from a variety of sources, including the notable celebrities that you would expect and a lot of businesses. The controversies have come up when there have been some strange, well, I guess not so strange on a heated political issue here, activities on both sides. There, a few weeks ago, there were some reports of No on 8 supporters tearing up signs in San Diego County of the Yes on 8 supporters. And recently, there have been some strong-arm tactics by Yes on 8 they've basically sent notices to businesses who have given money to the No on 8 campaign and requested the same amount of money be given to the Yes on 8 campaign. And if that money isn't given, then they'll publish their name and saying that this business is against traditional marriage values. And it's totally legal, even though it sounds extortionary, totally legal, and it's just strong-arm political tactics.
And, of course, they've been running the ubiquitous ads. Let's listen to, I guess this would be a yes on Prop 8.
Don't gay and lesbian couples deserve the same amount of happiness as other couples?
To use the arguments of happiness, though an effective diversion, misses the point. Proposition 8 is about protecting the legal definition of marriage and religious freedoms on which this country was founded.
And let's just quickly listen to the No on Prop 8 ad.
Hello, I'm No on Prop 8.
And I'm Yes.
And I'm the California Constitution.
Whoa. She's more beautiful
in person. I mean,
she sure is. I'm totally going to amend her.
What?
Yeah.
No, I don't think you should do that. I mean, she's perfect the way she is.
Yeah, but she'd be even better with a little discrimination in her. You know what I mean?
So both sides getting creative in their advertising. Do you think this is going to drive people to the polls, this issue?
I think it will. I think it will definitely mobilize both sides of the issue. There are strong feelings on both sides. The Yes on 8 campaign has been looking at the issues that they claim will come up if this amendment doesn't pass. They have been putting out ads that are saying that schools will be teaching about gay marriage. And then you saw the No on 8 campaign come out with a commercial with the superintendent of schools of California saying that marriage is not required to be taught in California schools, and passing Prop 8 will not change anything about how schools run in California at all. So it's very interesting how, because for the No on 8 people, this is a civil rights issue. And when it becomes a civil rights issue, the strategy has to be to look at something else besides what people consider a civil rights issue in order to not make it seem so unpopular.
Dan Fritz, many thanks. In a week, they'll know there in California what the decision is on Proposition 8. Dan Fritz is the news producer with KPFK, Pacifica Radio for Southern California. And now we're going to head to Femi Oke, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Asian markets recovered today after several plummeting for several days in a row. Japan's Nikkei index closed up more than 6%. All major indices in Europe are posting gains as well. The Iraqi cabinet has authorized Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to reopen talks with the U.S. on a new security pact. The agreement would allow the U.S. to remain in Iraq until 2011. Iraqi officials noted yesterday that opponents of the pact may have been bolstered by the U.S.'s Sunday attack on al-Qaeda operatives in Syria. North Korean leader Kim Jong-il is probably in the hospital, according to Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso. His intelligence reports say that the leader's condition is poor, but he's still able to make decisions. They believe he's being treated by a French brain surgeon. Federal agents have stopped an alleged plot by two white supremacists to assassinate Barack Obama and more than 100 African Americans at a Tennessee school. The two men are being held for firearm charges and threatening a presidential candidate. And yesterday marked the first ever suspension of a World Series game. Rain ended the game in a 2-2 tie between the Philadelphia Phillies and the Tampa Bay Rays. They begin again at the bottom of the sixth tonight. The Phillies lead the series 3-1.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adoree Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Something more to add to the mix on America's exit poll. Adora was just talking with someone about a ballot measure in California. If you voted early and have voted for a ballot measure or against a ballot measure, let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's something else to talk about. Apparently, over the weekend, an endorsement on a website that's authoritatively connected to al-Qaeda issued something of an endorsement for John McCain. It's not unprecedented for al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations to weigh in on the electoral campaign, and we want you to weigh in on the significance of this endorsement.
Khrushchev wore a Kennedy button back in the election in 1960, and it had no impact, even though a lot of Nixon supporters published it. I think this endorsement of al-Qaeda for McCain will have absolutely no impact at all in this election.
877-8-MY-TAKE. That's how you can reach us with your reaction to McCain's apparent endorsement by al-Qaeda. And 4 years ago, bin Laden attempted to weigh into the election between George Bush and John Kerry. Joining us now is Nicholas Kristof, New York Times columnist who wrote about the endorsement on the website for John McCain and got an enormous amount of response from his readers. Nick Kristof, thanks so much for being with us.
And my pleasure.
It's not unprecedented for organizations of all types around the world to be concerned and greatly interested in the outcome of U.S. presidential elections. Our listener there mentioning that Khrushchev wore a Kennedy button. What do you think the significance of this endorsement is for John McCain right now?
It certainly would have less impact on John McCain than if it had been the other way around. If al-Qaeda had endorsed Obama, then that would have fit into this narrative of, you know, this guy who may be a little bit squishy on Islam, who we're a little unsure about, this kind of thing. I think that coming for McCain, I don't think it hurts him nearly as much as it would have hurt Obama. But we'll have to see. I think it certainly reflects, at least from my point of view, the preference that that groups like al-Qaeda do have for a sort of a tough, fulminating line, longer time in Iraq, and this kind of thing that I think really helped their long-term recruiting.
Well, the headline is disclosure that while there might have been some ambiguity about what al-Qaeda did in issuing a video with Osama bin Laden in 2004, seeming to sort of endorse Kerry, but the CIA analysis of that tape suggested that, no, in fact, that was an attempt to manipulate, and a clear preference was for George Bush. Here, the preference is clearly for John McCain, and it would seem to be there are pragmatic reasons for that. What do you think the pragmatic reasons on al-Qaeda's part are for this endorsement?
Well, al-Qaeda's main issue is recruiting. They need a constant flow of new people into their ranks to be suicide terrorists, to be fighters, and they also need a sort of a vaguely supportive local population in places where they operate to endorse their efforts. And that's much easier to do at a time when local people are really mad at the U.S. And so if you have a U.S. president who is committed to staying in Iraq for a very, very long time, to having bases abroad, who has a general inclination to use to address problems with military force, then that's much easier to rouse supporters and get people indignant than if you have this African-American president with a Muslim grandfather who just does not fit their narrative.
Well, that's easy enough to conclude. Recruitment obviously is the lifeblood of an organization like al-Qaeda. But how difficult has it been for al-Qaeda to get its message out compared to 2004? There have been difficulties with their websites over the last few weeks.
Yeah, they've had a number of websites that have been they have a whole bunch of websites, and they communicate very effectively. They really know their internet. And they're committed when they do attacks. They're committed to videoing them sometimes from multiple angles and then putting them on these websites. But a number of those have been closed down. The one that this was posted on is Al Husba, which is a password-protected site. So this was not quite like the 2004 video that was sent out publicly. This was more a sort of a commentary for internal use. And we may not have we may not have seen the real weighing in, the real equivalent of that 2004 video. That may still be yet to come. And there's a lot of nervousness, I think, in the intelligence community that there could indeed be some kind of an attack in the run-up to the election.
But just in terms of a communique per se, do you think it would have the same impact this time around, given it's 4 years later and in some level the public gets desensitized to these videos and the audio recordings that we've been hearing over and over again for 7 years plus?
Yeah, and certainly we're 4 more years removed from 9/11. I think if it were just a video, that would not have the impact. But, I mean, I think there's a general sense in the intelligence community that if al-Qaeda has the capacity to engage in an attack, then the run-up to the election would be a time when they would very well likely to do that. Nobody knows whether they have that capacity.
Well, but is that what your sources are telling you, that the security establishment, if there's a capability, they expect that it would be used between now and the election day?
Well, I mean, of course, nobody really knows, but there is a strong sense that al-Qaeda likes to intervene in elections, and that's based partly on the 2004 video and partly on the Spanish, the bombing in Spain right on the eve of the election,
which actually was decisive. It brought down the government.
Exactly.
All right. And well, Nick, it's something definitely to think about over breakfast this morning. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Nicholas Kristof is a New York Times columnist who wrote about the endorsement of John McCain, apparently, by al-Qaeda on an internal website. More details to come. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Futures point toward a much higher open on Wall Street today. Dow Industrials are up almost 5%. Markets in Asia and Europe had good days as well. The aerospace corporation Boeing has reached a tentative settlement to end a 7-week-long machinist union strike. The deal will enhance job security, which had been a key sticking point. Analysts estimate the 52-day strike has cost the airplane maker approximately $1.4 billion. Classes are back in session at the University of Central Arkansas today. They were cancelled yesterday after a Sunday night shooting left 2 students dead. No one has been charged in connection with the killings, but 3 people have been detained. And it's been 6 weeks since the historic day when President Robert Mugabe and the main opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai agreed to share power. That was the last time they agreed on anything. Since then, talks have continued and failed and started up again about the crucial breakdown of the cabinet. Arthur Mutambara, who leads one of the small opposition parties in Zimbabwe, has been intending the latest round of talks.
Mugabe cannot go solo. Mugabe cannot form a government on his own in this country. He can't run this country on his own. So he has no alternative but to sit in there, discuss and agree.
I'm not sure that President Mugabe got that message, because after 13 hours of talks yesterday, still no agreement. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon on Monday said that it was urgent to resolve the ongoing political impasse so that recovery can begin in Zimbabwe.
Right, that's going to work. Oh, sure. Femi, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And how annoying is it to lose software, or to lose a hard drive, or to have to buy software over again that you thought you'd bought but lost the password to? and how possible is it that
all of
your software issues could actually be resolved up in the clouds? Well, Andy Jordan joins us. He's the Wall Street Journal's technology reporter. And, you know, we've always heard that in the box is the software, and that is the key to your computing experience if you have a laptop or a desktop. But in fact, the software doesn't even have to be in the box. Explain what that means and how many of us are probably already experiencing that now.
Well, I have to say your view of cloud computing is a bit sanguine, according to the way people use it. But essentially, when you take software and you put it on a different server other than your own computer, you have someone else host, say, a word processing program or calendar, You do this with Facebook, with Gmail. We've been used to cloud computing for some time now.
Google is all that way, right?
Google is all that way. We've done this for some time. In a sense, it's kind of a buzzword, cloud computing. And there are good uses of it. It takes all of the onus off of you of storing your data, of your processing power, and puts it on a data center somewhere else in the world, and you don't have to worry about it.
And it means you're probably backed up automatically. It means the licensing arrangements are taken care of automatically. And Microsoft is suddenly getting into the act. Explain what's happening.
Well, this is a big deal for Microsoft because it's really essentially the first time they're tipping the hat to this democratization of technology, to what Google has been honing in on their territory. You know, they offer these bundled packages of Office and word processing, and Google has come up with Google Docs and said,
Google Calendar, Google all these things.
Yeah. And that we're going to sort of invade your territory. And this is sort of the
Apple's
first
also
time.
Got an environment. Mobile Me, iCal, and all those sorts of programs.
Absolutely. And this is sort of the equivalent of Microsoft doing what Apple did with the iPhone App Store, saying you can come in and develop your own applications and do what you want to do, sort of taking the future of how we use technology and putting it into the hands of the people rather than a boardroom.
Getting it out of the object zone where you're buying stuff at a store that you plug into your computer and actually subscribe to environments that serve your needs in some way.
Absolutely. And, you know, the cloud is just really another term for the internet, and it's largely a buzzword.
But none of this would be possible if it wasn't for the fact of wireless broadband and even wired broadband proliferating really over the last 7 to 10 years.
Absolutely.
You can't even do this on phone dial-up. So this really is a phenomenon of the last 10 years.
It is. But I think what's important about it and what interests me is how it fits into this larger notion of democratizing. Many industries are going through this. The recording industry.
Right.
Journalism is going through it with citizen journalism.
And the CIA loves this, right? Correct, buddy.
You too can be a CIA agent.
Yeah, right. You too can sell your information for free to the government.
For free. And it's part of this free culture. And what interests me about this is it brings about issues, you know, about people said when podcasting first came out, it was going to be the big equalizer and that everybody was going to be able to be a journalist. And if you look at iTunes,
some of that is true. And in fact, as with all of these technologies, and we're so thrilled that you came down here to the studio for just this little segment, the users are going to define this.
Right.
And that's the great thing.
If you look at iTunes,
I love you, but we got to go. Andy Jordan, Wall Street Journal technology reporter. Thanks for coming down.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 28th, and Femi Okeh's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Iraq's cabinet is sending proposed amendments to a long-awaited agreement with the U.S. about its presence in Iraq. The U.S. had previously said the existing draft of the deal, known as SOFA, was final and needed few changes. Negotiators are trying to finalize something before the end of the year deadline. Wall Street isn't open for another 40 minutes or so, but Europe is up and running right now. So far, strong gains in Germany, the UK and French indices, and this after Asian markets also closed higher. On the campaign trail, there's a sense of urgency from Pottsville, Pennsylvania. The Republican presidential nominee, John McCain, says his opponent is proposing too much new spending.
If I'm elected president, I won't spend nearly $1 trillion more of your money. Senator Obama will, and he can't do that without raising your taxes.
It's like the House of Commons there. And in Pittsburgh, Barack Obama says that there are many reasons to admire John McCain, but that doesn't mean McCain should be in the White House.
When it comes to the economy, when it comes to the central issue of this election, the central issue for working families all across this region, he don't get it.
And both the candidates will be campaigning in Pennsylvania this morning, and also Joe Biden will be campaigning in Florida. Global markets are on Iceland's mind. The Nordic state's prime minister says the country needs $6 billion in loans to avoid economic collapse. The International Monetary Fund has pledged $2 billion, and Iceland's central bank has raised key interest rate to 6%, from 6% to 18% to attract investors. And that's a look at the news for now.
18%?
Wow. Thank you, Femi.
Going to change my savings account.
Okay, good. Good. Better get started on that. So we've been hearing 7 days to the election.
Sorry,
seven
didn't mean to interrupt.
Seven days to the election, and some people are worried.
I'm worried about people hacking into computers to change districts' votes.
Or to change your savings account, huh, Femi? We want to hear from you. We're conducting America's exit poll, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. People are voting all over America.
John and Femi, here's a story for you. Public health officials are gearing up for the largest children's study ever undertaken in the United States, and it's set to launch in 2009. Researchers are planning on tracking 100,000 kids from the womb, I should say, from birth all the way through to 21 years old. They're hoping that 2 decades worth of all kinds of samples, including hair and urine and environmental, will help explain why childhood diseases are rising. Joining us now is Kate Murphy, a New York Times contributor who writes about the study in today's Science Times. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So give us the details of what the plan is.
Well, the plan is, as you said, to follow 100,000 children from before birth until they're age 21. And what they will do is, while they are in utero, they will take blood samples as well as blood samples from the mother. And then once they are born, they will be periodically tested, take hair samples, nail samples, blood, saliva, to track them and their health throughout their life. And the other thing that's quite interesting about it is not only will they be tracking their health, but they will be taking samples from their environment. They'll be looking for metals, things like phthalates, estrogen mimicking substances, bisphenol A, mercury, to see how these types of chemicals may be impacting a child's health as they grow.
One of the fascinating aspects of this is they're only tracking the child and the mother, right?
Exactly. The fathers will be encouraged to participate, but they won't be required. So the thinking there is that maybe the father won't be around, or also just because, as you said, this is the largest study. It's 100,000 children and their mothers, you know, to try and bring the father in too is going to be quite difficult. And I think they want to concentrate on just keeping the children and the mothers in the study, and that those are the primary data points. But that's really one of the concerns and a bit of the controversy is whether or not they'll be able to keep these 100,000 children and mothers engaged for 21 years. Because when you sign on for this, it's quite a commitment. And you may think it's a good idea, you know, when you're pregnant and think, oh, you know, this will follow my child's health. But, you know, when you get into it and it's a couple of years on and they're still asking for blood, and maybe your kid is a teenager and says, I don't want to do that. You just, you know, you wonder what the retention rate's going to be.
Yeah, clearly that would be an obstacle, particularly over such a long period of time. How did they recruit these families, and do they have, the scientists, do they have their 100,000?
Well, they haven't started yet. They've just been gearing up of how they're going to do this, and they'll start in January 2009, and they're starting actually in Queens, in New York, as well as in North Carolina, hog farming country, kind of opposite ends of the pole.
Well, hey, I have 4 kids. How much can I make in this deal?
Well, probably by the end of it, I mean, I think by the end of 4 years, they hope to get the 100,000, but it's going to be quite an undertaking. But the thing that's really quite interesting about it is the way they're doing the sampling. They're doing it in 105 counties across the United States, and they're actually going and knocking on doors. They're not just, you know, taking people who are coming into hospitals or into doctors' clinics, which is the way usually you take subjects for scientific studies.
And, Kate, why did they choose to do it that way?
Because they want to get a representative sample, and you're not going to get that of just people that are coming into clinics. They're going out and, you know, like I said, you know, hog farming country, people who may not go to the hospital to have a baby. So they're really trying to get, you know, a real cross-section so it really looks like kids in America, not just people that are around research medical centers and would be coming into those clinics.
Speaking of research medical centers, who's involved and who had this idea to begin with?
Well, who's involved are really those major medical centers. Those are the ones that are going to be collecting the data, but they're going to have doctors and clinicians going out into the community and also into these, you know, more rural areas that they may not reach ordinarily. And then the inception, to answer your question about the inception, is this really started back during the Clinton administration. During that time, there were all these concerns about lead exposures and fetal alcohol syndrome and also a surge in incidence of autism and asthma. And so they formed a presidential task force on environmental health to provide recommendations on how to control exposures. And once this group got together, they realized, you know what, we don't have enough data to provide any guidance. So that's when they started to think, well, I think we better do a really big study.
And certainly not enough data from hog farming areas in
North
Carolina.
No, yes. Not at all.
So you're talking about the Center for Disease Control, the National Institutes of Health, and other universities and institutions, and potentially a gold mine if all goes well. And they'll be reporting some of their findings as they go?
Absolutely. That's what's really interesting about it, and also how they talk about, because there's a lot of concern about how much this is going to cost. We're talking $3 billion with a B, billion dollars, by the time it's all said and done. And how they counter that, you know, how it's worth it and how it will pay for itself is, you know, as they go through, they'll be releasing information and hopefully give clinicians an idea of what the causes of some of these childhood disorders. For example, they've already started, they did what one of the researchers told me is a dress rehearsal for this larger study, starting with 1,500 children. And he said from that study that's been going on for this dress rehearsal, rather, that's been going on for about 6 years, that they've already found that organophosphates in pesticides are cause children to have to be born with small brains and thus have cognitive disorders later on in life.
Wow, Kate. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Well, you're quite welcome.
Kate Murphy is a contributor to the New York Times, and she has the story about this study, this children's study, in the Science Times today. The National Children's Study, that's what it's called.
It sounds great, and more of that kind of transitional long-term study is needed as we go forward in the century. We're always on at The Takeaway, of course. In a new video, Al-Qaeda is endorsing John McCain for the 08 election, and we're asking you, what does it mean for his campaign? Here's The Takeaway.
It certainly would have less impact on John McCain than if it had been the other way around.
That's Nick Kristoff from our partner, The New York Times. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Dan Waters writes on our website, Al-Qaeda's real reason for endorsing American presidential candidates, first Kerry in 04 and now McCain, is to annoy us by having existed for so long that they're now a fixture in our elections. In 2012, if they're still around, they'll probably want to host one of the televised debates in Afghanistan. That would be rough, but we'd get some satellite signals out of there. If you missed anything, we're on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Extreme Washington Makeover.
Today we're going to talk about the ABCs of home decorating.
This has been a long and hard-fought trial. The department is proud of this team, not only for this trial, but for the investigation which led to it. This investigation continues, as does our commitment to holding elected officials accountable
when they violate our laws.
Rule one in interior decorating, pay for it yourself, especially if you are a U.S. senator. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens may do hard time for taking comfy chairs and other stuff from an oil exec. Black eye for the corrupt guy. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Tuesday, October 28th.
Come on, get it together. Come on. We got a new show to do here. You got to pay for it yourself if you're a U.S. senator. Good morning, Adora. We've lost Adora.
Good morning, John.
How long is it to election day?
Excuse me.
Yeah,
just a week to election day, so we'll satisfy your political cravings with coverage of all the angles. Plus, a closer look at the attack in Syria and what it means for the U.S. and the greater Middle East. Those stories are coming up, but first, a few headlines.
Wall Street opens about 30 minutes from now. Was it a bottom or just a bump of volatility? Based on futures trading, it's going to start on a positive note. This on a day when European markets are up. Asian markets are also higher. Today, the Dow yesterday, the Dow lost 2.4% to close at 81.75 in a day of extraordinarily volatile trading. That's going to be tested this morning. Oil prices are loitering around the $64 a barrel range this morning, and that's a bounce back from an earlier dip almost to $60 a barrel.
And if you feel good about the economy, you'll probably spend more money. That's why investors will closely watch new consumer confidence numbers that are due out in about an hour. Also, the Federal Reserve kicks off a two-day meeting today, and it's widely expected to announce an interest rate cut tomorrow. Iraq's prime minister plans to reopen talks with the United States on a new agreement about its troop presence in Iraq. The cabinet handed over suggested changes to him a little while ago. Right now, the U.S. and Iraq have a draft agreement that would allow American troops in Iraq for three more years, and the clock is ticking on that since their current legal allowance runs out at the end of the year.
It's a full-scale invasion of Pennsylvania today. Candidates are blanketing the state. John McCain was in Pottsville promising a break from Bush's policies.
We can't spend the next 4 years as we have spent much of the last eight hoping for our luck to change at home and abroad. We have to act. We need a new direction, and we have to fight for it.
And Obama forces were in the West in Pittsburgh.
In 1 week, you can choose policies that invest in our middle class and create new jobs and grow this economy so that everyone has a chance to succeed.
The invasion is secure in Pennsylvania today. Barack Obama and John McCain will be there before moving elsewhere. And it was rain, not hail, in Philly last night. The World Series is tied 2-2 in the bottom of the sixth. It may resume today, although the weather is pretty miserable. It's America's Exit Poll.
It's open. We want to hear your stories about voting. Have you voted for president? Have you voted on a ballot initiative? We want to hear your story. 8778, my take.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This has been a long and hard-fought trial. The department is proud of this team, not only for this trial, but for the investigation which led to it. This investigation continues, as does our commitment to holding elected officials accountable when they violate our laws.
That was Acting Assistant Attorney General Matt Friedrich speaking after a jury convicted Alaska Senator Ted Stevens of felony corruption yesterday. The longest-serving Republican senator was found guilty of seven counts of lying on his disclosure forms to conceal gifts, including tens of thousands of dollars of remodeling work on his home. And right now, the senator is in a tight race for re-election. For more, we go now to Alaska Public Radio reporter Libby Casey in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning, Adora.
What was the senator's reaction when he was found guilty of seven felonies?
Oh, there was just silence in the courtroom. Senator Stevens slumped slightly when the jury said guilty on the first count, but then otherwise was very still and quiet. And, you know, his staffers, just their faces fell. They looked physically ill, and Stevens' lawyers were shaking their head no. But the jury said one by one on all the counts, guilty, guilty, guilty.
Describe what led up to the verdict. Now, this is a jury where there'd been some changes in the last couple of days.
Well, we didn't really expect a verdict yesterday because just yesterday morning, one of the jurors was replaced by an alternate. On Thursday night, a juror had to leave town suddenly because of a death in her family. And so court was halted on Friday, resumed yesterday morning with this alternate, and they had to kind of backtrack and get the new juror up to speed. So we were all a little bit surprised when they came at a verdict so quickly yesterday afternoon.
And, of course, what was the senator's response to the verdict?
Well, he left the courthouse with his lawyers, almost sort of acting as bodyguards, shielding him from the press and people wanting to get a response from him. He jumped into a white van and sped away. However, about 2 hours after the guilty verdicts came down, he put out a statement saying, "I am innocent," and that he's disappointed by the verdict. He plans to keep fighting for the U.S. Senate seat. He plans to appeal this. He plans to go back to Alaska this week and pick up campaigning. And he basically blamed the guilty verdicts on prosecutorial misconduct.
And at this point, he's facing potentially up to 35 years in prison.
That's right. I mean, that seems astounding, but it surely won't get to that. I mean, he may look at a little bit of prison time, but it just goes to show that, you know, 7 counts times 5 years in prison potentially for each one is pretty serious. And this is the first sitting senator in decades to be convicted of a crime. He's only one of 5 senators ever to be convicted of a felony.
And so how do you think this is going to go over in his reelection bid? I mean, he's in a very tight race.
That is the million-dollar question, and my colleagues at Alaska Public Radio up in all over the state have been asking Alaskans, what do you think? And the response has been really varied, and people in the lower 48 may be surprised that Alaskans might consider putting this guy back in office, a convicted felon. But there's a lot of loyalty to Senator Stevens. He essentially helped found the state of Alaska. He's been a senator for 40 years. So time will tell. I mean, it may not be until election night when we find out really how Alaskans weigh in. I've talked to a couple of folks who voted early through absentee ballots, and they said even though they were sort of horrified by this corruption scandal in Alaska, they hesitated when they went to cast their ballot for this seat because there is so much loyalty for the senator.
So Ted has to get George Bush to pardon him now, between now and the election. That's pretty much it, right?
You know,
just call
as far
up George.
As far as I know, no senator convicted of a crime has ever received that presidential pardon, but the two go back. So, you know, it could happen.
And the tradition is in the Senate that they wait for due process to take place, right? So they would not potentially act, because they could expel him.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if Alaskans reelect Senator Stevens, the only group that has the power to remove him from office is the Senate itself, and it takes a 2/3 vote. A couple heavy-hitting Republicans came out right away yesterday and condemned, I guess, the convictions. But a couple of Republicans, like Senator Lisa Murkowski, our other Alaskan senator, have come out supporting him. You know, I guess, will senators want to act quickly with this, you know, in the sort of a lame duck session or as we move into the new year, or would they wait and follow through the appeals process?
Well, redecorating is fraught with peril, as Ted Stevens is learning today. That's great stuff, Libby.
Well, thanks, you guys. I appreciate your interest in this. It's been fun talking with you about
it. Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much. Libby Casey, Alaska Public Radio Network reporter, coming to us from Washington, D.C.
From Alaska to Washington, D.C. to Pennsylvania, we shift now. Jen Rehill joins us. She's bureau chief for the Public Radio Capital News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to talk about Pennsylvania becoming the scene for these last days and hours of the campaign. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
Give us a sense of how many resources are deployed in your state, you know, from the number of commercials on television all the way to the number of appearances in locations around the state.
Well, let me start with the appearances, because the pacing of the appearances by the presidential candidates has been really frenetic in recent days. Yesterday, for instance, John McCain was in Pottsville, Pennsylvania. Today, he's making two stops in Hershey and Quakertown. Senator Obama was also in Pennsylvania yesterday. He stopped in Pittsburgh, and today he's going to be in Chester, which is just outside Philadelphia. Meantime, the surrogates are all over the state as well. Governor Rendell, who's a Democrat, is on a bus tour around the state trying to, you know, rally the troops for Obama. Bill Clinton is supposed to appear tomorrow in Harrisburg, which is right in the middle of the state. And former Governor Tom Ridge, who's a Republican, has been on a bus tour going around the state for John McCain. Now, if you turn on the television, you can't watch the evening news without seeing commercial after commercial after commercial for both candidates.
Well, you can't watch The View without seeing commercial after commercial, is from what I understand.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you can't watch CNN, MSNBC. It's just, it's everywhere. And, you know, it's interesting. I took a look at my local paper yesterday. That's the Patriot News here in Harrisburg. And the entire editorial page was all people writing in about the campaign, about their thoughts, about different issues. I think the electorate is really electrified by being the focus of attention now in this race.
Well, what are they after here, these candidates? Are they after convincing people? Are they going for some sort of undecided segment, or is this all about turnout on election day?
From what I'm hearing, this is about turnout on election day. There may be some effort to, you know, change the hearts and minds of the few undecided voters that may be left. I mean, essentially, in the state right now, according to several recent polls, Senator Obama has a double-digit lead in Pennsylvania, something like 53.
I'm sorry, Jen, go ahead.
And something like 53 to 40 points in the last Quinnipiac University poll.
Wow.
So please help us to try to understand this. We've talked to pollsters and to strategists. And what do you think that the McCain campaign is seeing there that no one else seems to be seeing?
Well, I'll tell you what Tom Ridge, our former Republican governor, has been saying to people. He's saying, this lead is not insurmountable, and the lead isn't double digits. He says this lead may be 5 or 6 points, and that we can play with. I think the Republicans are really trying to get the base excited and are hoping that Pennsylvania may swing back Republican. As one Republican operative said to me yesterday, if Senator McCain wins Pennsylvania, he wins the White House. So they are pulling out all the stops to try to do whatever they can in the Commonwealth.
That theory definitely depends on other things breaking McCain's way. But let's talk a little bit about the likely voter models, which we referred to earlier in our discussion on the program. I mean, is it possible that in this race, unlike other races where likely voters are overestimated, there are more likely, you conclude there are more likely voters than there actually turn out to be, that in this election, maybe just the opposite, that they're underrepresented, that more people are likely voters than the pollsters are actually reflecting here?
You know, I have heard that from some of the pollsters. You know, I think it's an unprecedented situation in Pennsylvania. Voter registration is at record numbers at 8.75 million at this point. We've seen a flood of young people registering at the polls, and there's a question about whether or not the polling is really accurately hitting all of the people who may come out in this election. Mm.
And we don't know if the likely voters in this new model are skewing McCain or Obama. Certainly younger voters and African-American voters are skewing, but there are a lot of groups in play here, and that's really the mystery. And it's so fascinating that you're right in the middle of it all, Jen.
Well, you know, that's why Pennsylvania is a swing state. Now, the last time Pennsylvania went for a Republican president was in 1984. So John McCain does have, I think, a bit of a hurdle here. But I would not underestimate the conservative voters in this state.
Well, we're going to be watching Pittsburgh. We're going to be watching Scranton. And we're going to be watching those Philadelphia suburbs. Jen Rehill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jen.
Jen Rehill is bureau chief for Public Radio Capital News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, talking about the swing state swinging back and forth from campaign to campaign.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The U.S. government is probably not enthusiastic about this, but the Iraqi government has said the cabinet has authorized Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to reopen talks with the United States on a security pact in Iraq. The agreement allows U.S. troops to stay in Iraq for three more years after the U.N. mandate expires on December 31st. The Bush administration thought it had a deal, but the parliament wants to reopen it. In any case, it's been 2 days since American military helicopters bombed the border of Syria, and officials are still only speaking under conditions of anonymity about the raid, which took place from inside Iraq. The cross-border raid by special forces killed the head of a key al-Qaeda network, along with eight civilians, and that's the report we're hearing anyway. Joining us now from the studios of KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma, is Joshua Landis, co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Now, this story is interesting on a number of levels. First of all, the target. Who is this al-Qaeda network person, and how significant in terms of operational importance does he have in funneling people across the border?
Well, his code name is evidently Abu Hadiya, but he's an Iraqi. He's in his 20s. He's been doing this for some time. The border between Syria and Iraq is about 300-some-odd miles. It goes through very tough territory, desert, and then other villages, farming villages. About 25-30% of the Syrian population in that area is below the poverty line, makes about $2 or less a day. So this is a very difficult territory. It's a tribal territory with the tribes on both sides of the line. It's a smuggler's paradise and has been for a long time. This is a top Iraqi, we're told, a top Iraqi smuggler who had been helping fighters get across the line. Money, other things go back and forth. Well, and Syria had not been cooperating the way the Americans wanted.
And which raises the issue of the timing of this attack, a question that was raised on the BBC's Today program from Richard Pearl, who's a former member of the Defense Policy Advisory Board. Take a listen to this, Joshua.
The administration should have been pursuing a policy like this a long time ago. A large number of people have been killed as a result of the freedom with which foreign fighters have crossed the border from Syria into Iraq.
Josh Landis, is Richard Pearl correct there? And does the restraint on the part of the U.S. Forces regarding the Syrian border, is it different than, say, cross-border attacks in Pakistan, which seem to be a fairly regular occurrence?
Well, you know, there's a big policy struggle on how to deal with Iraq's neighbors, and Syria has been a prime case. There are people like Richard Pearl and others, even John McCain, who called early on that, you know, Iraq was the first country, and then it would have to be Syria and Iran that America conquered or changed governments in. And so there was a big camp in America that wanted to go into Syria or to change the government in Syria immediately after the Iraq adventure. So this, you know, stuck us. And Powell and these other people said, no, we shouldn't be going after Syria. We should be having good relations with Syria because we need to fix Iraq first.
Well, certainly the Syrians' reaction to this raid suggests that it is the McCain policy that at least they believe is in force here. Take a listen to Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualem speaking today.
We don't want to enter in a war with the United States. It's enough wars they have in the world, isn't it? Enough crisis they got. And they put on the shoulder of the world the financial crisis, the hunger crisis, the expanding terrorism. It is enough for them. I am saying we are a civilized country. We want explanation. We want investigation for this aggression. If they said they are after some al-Qaeda elements, they must respect the public opinion and present their proofs.
That's Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualem today speaking about the U.S. raid on Sunday. Does the Syrian Foreign Ministry have a case here, Joshua?
Of course they have a case. And, you know, Syria is played tough on this issue. And in 2007, Secretary of State Rice and Mualla met at Sharm el-Sheikh in May 2007. They had a big debate over intelligence sharing. The U.S. and Syria had broken off their intelligence sharing in 2005. Syria wanted to reinstate it, and many Americans did too in 2007. Rice asked Syria to send two generals to Damascus to rekindle this sharing. Mualla said, okay, we are eager to work on this border issue, but you have to resend an ambassador back here. America had pulled out as ambassador after the killing of of Rafiq al-Hariri in Lebanon, prime minister.
Sure.
They accused Syria of doing this. So relations had gone from bad to worse. There was an attempt to fix this up. Syria said, you've got to resend your ambassador. We want intelligence sharing, but you have to recognize our help to you across this border. This was too much for the United States to do, and it never happened. So this is the background to this. You know, do you have good relations with Syria and try to get them to do this through intelligence sharing, or should you, in the Pearl sense, you know, just bomb them and force them to comply with you?
So this is a slipping back from a situation that was, as you say, was already a stalemate. Now, there are reports that this operation is something that came off the table of the Joint Chiefs, who are attempting to preempt a new administration where presumably all tactical operations will be reviewed. They wanted to get this done before the election. Is that your view here?
You know, I don't know how and where this went through, but obviously, the election has some bearing on this because you know, first of all, the Syrians are fed up with George Bush. There's been a series of events that have just made things go from bad to worse. And so they're not cooperating right now. And the military, the boots on the ground in Iraq, are fed up with the situation. And they don't care about what the politics are. But I'm sure they were looking at that timeline and saying national elections are going to happen. One can only presume that after the elections, the Bush administration will have to, you know, out of protocol, politeness, whatever you want to call it, touch base with whoever the new president is going to be about invading a country in which we're not in war.
Well, a confluence of politics and regional policy. Joshua Landis, thanks for setting it in context for us.
It's a pleasure.
Joshua Landis is co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He spoke with us from the studios of KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma. And now Femi Okeh with some headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 29 minutes past the hour. Just looking at the futures, it looks like the Nikkei is up. The market's opening in just a few minutes, so I'll bring you the latest from the markets then. Let's just see how investors respond to news that home prices tumbled by the sharpest annual rate ever in August. In Europe, Iceland needs $6 billion to pull out of its fiscal crisis, but it only has a tentative OK for $2 billion from the IMF. Pakistan also needs a loan. Germany's foreign minister says the country needs emergency funds from the IMF to avoid financial crisis. And in Monday night football, the Tennessee Titans beat the Indianapolis Colts by 10 points. And the Titans are the last undefeated team in the NFL with a 7-0 record.
And the hapless Colts are 3-4,
I think. Oh, my goodness. Like that. That's amazing.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I think the American people and the gentleman running for president will have to early on focus on education more than we have seen in the campaign so far. America has a terrible educational problem in the sense that we have too many youngsters not finishing school.
That's General Colin Powell, and he is doing something about it. America's Promise Alliance, a group that he founded, has just released a study. And, John, if you had to guess what the U.S. high school rate of graduation is, what would you think?
Well, Colin Powell doesn't sound very thrilled about it, so I would say it's probably down below, 70% or something.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is below. There are many, in many of the big cities, many high schools that have 50% or less graduation rate. And joining us to take a look at what's happening in the Chicago area is Carmita Vaughn. She is a chief of staff with the Chicago Public Schools. Good morning, and thank you for being with us, Carmita.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So your job really is to help the 400,000 kids in the Chicago system make it through 12th grade. How's that going?
Well, we've seen dramatic results over the past 5 years in terms of increases in our graduation rate, but overall the numbers are still dismal. Our graduation rate in Chicago, our cohort rate is 55%, which means of those students that start with us in ninth grade, roughly half of them will finish within 5 years.
And what are some of the obstacles that you're facing? What's happening, Carmita?
Well, we've spent the past 2.5 years doing a lot of research and situation analysis to figure out exactly what's happening with these students. It's not enough to just say, the percentages, but we really have to dig into finding out who these students are, what's driving them out of school. And what the data is telling us is, first of all, for most of these students, this is not a one-time decision. They don't wake up one morning and decide they want to leave school. It's a slow process that happens over time and sometimes starts as early as middle grades. The students start disengaging from school, absences go up, course grades start to go down. If there's not intense intervention and prevention with those students, then they can just slide through the cracks.
And what does that intervention look like?
For us, we've started, based on our data, we found that a key point of intervention is between the 8th and 9th grades. We find that we lose a lot of students in that 9th grade year. In fact, we were able to identify three leading indicators, which comprehensively equate to 76% of the students who eventually drop out, and we can find those indicators as early as 9th grade. Because of that, we focused on that transition into high school. In Chicago, we've done a lot of things around middle grades, but specifically before ninth grade, we have developed a 4-week orientation program for all incoming ninth graders. We found through pilot programs that students who spent a good deal of time in high school prior to coming there were much more likely to be engaged, had far fewer absences, and half the dropout rate of their peers.
Is it a preparation issue, do you think, that people are coming to school unprepared, or is it more a social issue that they're going to the big school with all the big kids and it's really kind of a sensory overload?
You know, I think there are a lot of things. When you talk to students, and we've done a lot of qualitative analysis by going out and doing focus groups, talking to students who are both currently enrolled as well as those who have dropped out, and you find that it's a lot of things. For some students, it is the going from a nurturing elementary environment to a big kind of scary high school where you're expected to behave as an adult and know what to do and when to do it and get your things done on time. For a lot of our students, we in Chicago, just as large urban cities across the world or across the country, are facing a lot of social issues. So these students are struggling getting to school safely. They're struggling with having to work and care for family members, care for children, and have a lot of competing priorities. So if they aren't in environments that are personalized and designed to meet their specific needs and be flexible to what their needs are, they often find themselves having to make tough choices.
Carmita, the Wall Street Journal reports about some of the fundamental impacts on our economy, for example, citing that the number of dropouts, if you could just cut it in half, would generate about $45 billion annually in new tax revenue for people who are working, assuming that they can get a job. But also that, a high school graduate is the difference between not graduating and graduating is about $300,000 over a lifetime in employment. Is it not a priority of elected officials? Is it a not a priority of some communities, of families? I mean, where is the disconnect of putting pressure on making the system better?
Well, I don't think that it's not a priority. I think it's been a silent epidemic for quite a while. One of the things that came out in the study is that for a number of cities and states, these numbers just had not been reported at the levels that we're seeing now. And it's because we were looking at things like one-year dropout rates, and though that really equates to how many students who started with us in 1 year actually finished that year. And looking at numbers like that can really mask the problem. And because we don't have a national standard for looking at graduation rates and dropout rates, I think the problem has been masked for the past 10, 20 years. So I don't think that it's not a priority. I think now, and in large part based on the work of America's Promise Alliance and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and folks across the country who are bringing this to the national stage, you're starting to see folks really start to embrace this, look at the issue, drive towards solutions, both at the federal and local levels.
Carmita Vaughn, sounding very hopeful. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Carmita Vaughn is a chief of staff in the Chicago Public Schools, and she was describing what potentially could be a new chapter in the discussion about public education, specifically high school. Now we're going to go to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Dora. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour, and the Dow is up around about 200 points at the open on Wall Street, and that was about 10 minutes ago. A 20-city housing index released today reports on almost 17% drop in prices from a year ago. Prices have plummeted more than 20% since their peak in July 2006. Classes are being held at the University of Central Arkansas today, and they were cancelled yesterday after a Sunday night shooting left two students dead. No one has been charged in connection with the killings, but three people have been detained. Syria has called on the United States and Iraq to investigate a helicopter raid inside Syria on Sunday, in which eight people were killed, including four children, and which Syria has blamed on America. At a news conference in the White House, President Bush's spokeswoman, Dana Perino, brushed off reporters' demands for more information.
So you can come up here and try to beat it out of me, but I will not be commenting on this in any way, shape, or form today or tomorrow.
That's a brush off?
That's her final answer.
That's a lock and load.
You may not call your friend.
That's right.
The answer is still no comment. And the United States government has still refused to comment officially, though reports say that they were after Al-Qaeda-linked fighters.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And the NBA opens its season tonight. And along with figuring out if the Celtics are for real, the Mavericks are going to be players, if this is going to be LeBron James's year with the Cleveland Cavaliers, or if the Clippers or the Lakers are going to be the big team on the West Coast, there's a business issue that's really on the minds of all people involved in basketball this year. And the question is, has the economic crisis caused a crisis for the business model in professional sports? And here to talk about it is Raymond Sauer, who's an economics professor at Clemson University. He comes to us from Clemson, South Carolina. Thanks for joining us, Raymond.
Good morning.
So is the business model for the NBA inflated at a time when maybe economic hardship would argue for lower price tickets, more of a working class approach to professional sports? And is the NBA going to take a hit from this?
Well, I think all sports are going to take a hit from it. They've positioned themselves to attract corporate revenue, to obtain lots of sponsorship money from financial services firms. That's the dominant industry in terms of sports sponsorship. So they're hitting a rough patch, that's for sure.
So the skybox idea, the high price tickets, the sort of Jack Nicholson on the court, $5,000 a game ticket model is really hurting the game in terms of broad ticket sales for people who are real hardcore fans.
Well, I think Jack's a hardcore fan, and he's probably doing fine. But the corporate purchases of luxury boxes are going to be the place where they're going to have trouble selling tickets. So they're going to have to find other customers.
What about media contracts? I mean, if television is the source of major revenue for the NBA, and we should point out that the NBA has the highest price salary level of all professional sports, if media contracts are really the big revenue source, does the NBA get much benefit if most fans are spending their time in sports bars drinking, you know, cheap beer, watching the games for free?
Well, it depends on what else they're willing to spend their money on, because advertisers are going to advertise their products and pay for the media contracts that end up flowing to the NBA only if they think they can sell something. So advertising revenue is a big threat looking ahead. Right now, the contracts are already in place, but there could be some renegotiation and a downgrade in the value of those contracts in the near future.
What about the competition for NBA talent outside of the United States? How's that changed?
I think this is where it gets really interesting. You had two high-profile players sign European contracts this year, including the top pick for the college ranks, Brandon Jennings, who decided to abandon a commitment to Arizona and go play in Rome.
And Josh Childress went from the Atlanta Hawks to the Greek team.
To a Greek team, Olympiakos, playing for a billionaire who's willing to put up just as much money to get the next guy. So this is another challenge for the NBA, but this is a competitive challenge from, I think, the globalization of professional basketball, particularly in Europe, but throughout the world.
Well, we've got globalization issues. We've also got a kind of a reversal. I mean, you would think that entertainment and sports would be a safe, recession-proof kind of business. But as you're pointing out, it may not be the case the way these professional teams have positioned themselves. Raymond Sauer, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, pleasure.
Raymond Sauer is a professor of economics at Clemson University. He joined us from Clemson, South Carolina, with a look at the business model for professional sports.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, October 28th, and Femi Oke has joined us with some headlines.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens has been in office for 40 years. Now he faces a prison term that could be almost as long as his Senate career. And new this hour, Republican presidential nominee John McCain is calling for Stevens to step down. Stevens was convicted on 7 corruption charges yesterday and faces a tough re-election fight. He said yesterday he would not leave office. Polls taken before the verdict showed a tight race. Federal agents in Tennessee say they broke up an alleged plot to assassinate Senator Obama as part of a larger killing spree targeting African Americans. Two young men are charged with conspiracy. And finally, Michelle Obama appeared on NBC's Tonight Show with Jay Leno last night and told the late-night audience that her daughter Malia won't be watching her dad's political specials on Wednesday night. And this is how the 10-year-old reacted when she heard about the Obama TV buyout.
You're going to be on all the TV? She said, are you going to interrupt my TV?
Oh.
And he said, he's sitting like this. He says, no, we didn't buy time on Disney and Nick. And she said, oh, good.
And with just 1 week left to Election Day, Pennsylvania is in the spotlight today on the campaign trail. Barack Obama, John McCain and Sarah Palin all campaigning in that battleground state today.
They've got a real sense of the demographics there in the Obama campaign.
I'm surprised. Yeah. But maybe get the young voters early.
Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Given all of the economic turmoil, layoffs are becoming far too common for most Americans. And for a report on what's happening on the ground, we go now to economic forecaster Eric Jansen, who says that these layoffs, the ones that we've seen so far this year, roughly 760,000 or so, well, that's just the beginning of things to come. He joins us from the studios of our partner WGBH in Boston. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Adora.
For starters, let's talk about Rhode Island.
Yeah, Rhode Island made the front page of the Boston Globe a couple days ago. Its unemployment rate is pushing 9%, which is pretty high among states also that are already seeing increasing unemployment.
That's the highest in the state. Not necessarily the first place that you might think of. Describe what's happening there.
Well, the challenge for Rhode Island, like any state that does not have a well-diversified economy, is if the major sources of employment in the state are concentrated in industries that are getting hit by the recession, unemployment is going to tend to rise more quickly there in the state. And Rhode Island is very dependent on financial services, trade, general services, and government. And as we all know, the financial services industry has taken quite a hit.
I often hear that Main Street tends to lag behind what's happening on Wall Street. And is what's happening in Rhode Island a sign of what's to come? Because the worst hasn't hit Main Street yet, according to many analysts.
Well, the way for your listeners to think about it is, with respect to what the main industries are in the state that they live in. For example, Florida, which was very heavily dependent on the sale of secondary homes, which is a weaker part of the residential real estate market, and also tourism, which was being driven by a weak dollar. A lot of foreign folks were coming over from Europe and also from Asia. And the dollar's getting stronger, and also the economies are getting weaker in Asia and Europe, so there's less tourism. And, of course, we all know that the housing market is declining there. So that's another state that is having difficulty. Here in Massachusetts, it's a bit better. We have technology, biotech, education, healthcare, also some financial services, but generally the economy is relatively well diversified, and unemployment is so far staying relatively okay. It's about 5.5%.
But we're at the beginning of this at this point, Eric, and I'm wondering if diversification or a diverse economy is necessarily an antidote for what's to come. I mean, we're talking about maybe the auto industries. We may lose one of the car companies, and then there's all these subsidiaries, and including tech companies that go along with that. The financial service industry, you know, is incredibly sort of has its fingers in other parts of the economic pie. And, of course, nobody really knows what investments a lot of these companies have made and how leveraged or vulnerable they are to credit or lack of liquidity.
Well, my expectation is that we'll see unemployment levels very similar to what we saw around from the 1981 to 83 period. So very significant unemployment. So I'm not downplaying that. And that will really be caused by the necessary restructuring of the American economy, which has over the last 20 or 30 years become far too dependent on finance and financialization of industry. And we need to restructure to be much more focused on investment and saving than we have on borrowing and spending.
Do you think there are particular states, obviously the Midwest comes to mind with all of the troubles in the auto industry, that are really that you would expect to really go through some further tough times?
Yes, you can see extremely rapid growth in unemployment in Michigan and Ohio, primarily from companies that are doing parts manufacturing for the automobile industry. So the auto industry is clearly going to slow very quickly for two reasons: demand for cars, but also the auto industry in the U.S. became very financialized, that meaning that the business, the way that car companies started to make money was more on financing cars than on selling cars. And the problem is that, as you know, there's been a significant reduction in the availability of credit, and so it's really been a double whammy for the auto industry.
Explain why Arkansas, Oklahoma, and West Virginia have tiny declines in unemployment.
Well, that's a relatively recent phenomenon, and that's caused by these are energy states. And so during the period of time when the dollar was depreciating and energy prices were rising, we had a boost in our exports. And those states like Oklahoma and West Virginia that produce a lot of coal saw a boom in that are related to energy. However, now that energy prices are declining again, unfortunately, I think that a lot of those states that were benefiting from high commodity prices will also start to have problems.
So what are you most concerned about?
Well, the biggest concern is what the political reflex will be to address these issues. so far what I see is not encouraging. Writing checks to send people off for one last trip to Home Depot is not the solution. We need to be very thoughtful about how we spend our money to stimulate the economy, and it needs to be in the direction of encouraging a restructuring of the U.S. economy that really builds on its unique strengths.
Well, what is the restructuring then? If we go from financialization, as you say, to something else, what will that something else be?
Well, there's a misunderstanding that the United States doesn't make a lot of stuff, that we don't really manufacture anymore, and it's not true. The type of manufacturing that we do is different from other countries. It's all very high intellectual property content. The word innovation is used a lot. I prefer the word invention, and we are great inventors here. So we need to do more of that and less of the financial stuff. And one way to do that is for us to focus energy on the parts of our economy that we've been neglecting for the last 20 or 30 years. And those have to do with our energy infrastructure, our transportation infrastructure, as well as our communications infrastructure. And if we do that, coming out the other end of those investments, what it will do is cause the entire economy to be much more efficient and competitive.
Eric Jensen, we want to thank you for your thoughts today. Eric is the president of iTulip.com and a former venture capitalist.
Interesting forecast. We've got some market news on the way out here. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is sort of bouncing around 300 at this point. 325 it's registering right now. Has the market found a bottom? That's what's being tested today. There's a number of economic reports out. The Fed is meeting today and is expected to lower interest rates tomorrow. And also housing prices, at least according to one closely watched survey, took their biggest, steepest decline in the last month, year to year. We're also talking about the felony conviction of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens. John McCain, the candidate, has just called for Ted Stevens to resign. Perhaps John McCain wants to run for his seat in Alaska if things don't work out for him. But that's just my opinion. Anyway, Ted Stevens heads back home to his home state to continue his reelection campaign. Here's your takeaway.
People in the lower 48 may be surprised that Alaskans might consider putting this guy back in office, a convicted felon. But there's a lot of loyalty to Senator Stevens.
That's Alaska Public Radio's Libby Casey, who's been covering the Stevens story for us. And, of course, we're conducting America's Exit Poll. If you voted early, we want to hear all about it. Were there any problems? Was it easy? America's Democracy on America's Exit Poll.
Yes, this is Curtis from Hazleton, Pennsylvania. One competitive race that hasn't been mentioned throughout this whole election cycle is Mayor Lou Barletta. And he is obviously a Republican who is going to unseat the Democratic congressman because of his strong stance on illegal immigration. And that's one sign of hope that the state here, the Keystone State, might be going red.
Listen to those pundits out there at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytaketotakeaway.org. If you missed anything, we are on iTunes. You can take our podcast to go. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.